This is the Thanks for Sharing podcast, a podcast where we explore all things recovery, healing, and relationship. You can subscribe and download episodes wherever you listen to podcasts, and you can follow us on our social media pages. And while you're at it, I would love a review.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to Thanks for Sharing. I'm your host, Jackie Pack, and I have with me today, Rachel Allen.
Hi.
And today we're going to be talking about, we'll probably do a series on this topic, or we'll cover it from several different angles, but we're going to be talking about disordered intimacy and just get an idea for what that looks like, what we're talking about when we talk about disordered intimacy. I will say up front, there's not a lot of resources out there available. If, you know, sometimes I have people reach out to me and say, hey, where can I read more about this? What books would you recommend? And this is one where I'm not aware of books that really hit on disordered intimacy.
Yeah, I don't know that we coined this term. I don't know that Jackie coined this term, because Jackie is the first person that I've heard say disordered intimacy. But I think that in the way that we talk about it, the way that we use it in our office, it is kind of a synthesis of a lot of information from a lot of different places, including Karn's work and Pia Melody's work on codependency and Sue Johnson's work in emotion focus therapy. And so, like, it's kind of like the, oh, this is what we're talking. So when you pull from different angles and different lenses, you can kind of see how this shows up. But so far, I haven't seen a book written on it yet. And it is something that's in the ether. Like, I think a lot of therapists are talking about it, maybe not using these terms, but it is something that we talk about in our office a lot, in terms of like how intimacy can get disordered, how we can be really close to someone in one area and not close in another, and the kind of like walls, defense mechanisms, and things like that that we use to keep ourselves safe in intimacy.
Yeah. So typically, if we're talking about disordered intimacy, somewhere along the line, usually starting when we were young, intimacy went awry. And so then from there, it became disordered, right? Or we don't quite know how to approach intimacy, or we maybe are comfortable approaching intimacy to a point. And then, you know, beyond that point, we try not to go there. We try to keep other people at a distance from, you know, that place. Some people might describe, like, some partners or even like friends or stuff may say, I feel a wall. I can only get so close, and then I feel a wall that's there. So I think it's, you know, something that has gone awry. Like, sometimes I think, similar to like some of the literature out there on disordered eating, mm-hmm. or eating disorders, you know, they're talking about how that relationship with food went awry and has become, like, it's become unhealthy in some ways, right? Or it's not taking its natural trajectory. And I think that would be similar when we're talking about disordered intimacy.
Yeah. When I'm first, like, presenting this concept to people, I often use the courtship inventory in Facing the Shadow by Patrick Carnes. This is one thing that I think the courtship inventory, so it's only available, I've only ever seen it available for addicts through the addict workbook, right? And Karn's material. It is the most impressive tool for talking about intimacy. And I use it with partners. I use it with addicts. I use it with people who aren't coming to me for shame, betrayal, trauma, right? So, because it's talking about like the way that we kind of dive into more intimate relationships and kind of a step or a rhythm in which you would do that in a healthy way. And I think a lot of times, most of our, if we are experiencing like intimacy disorder, like, we get stuck in like the first five, and we may jump to a couple of others, but we're not like walking through into like a deeper sense of like renewal and connection and things like that.
Yeah. I say with me, right? And I think sometimes we get, like with sex addicts, right? A lot of times the earlier dimensions of courtship, they're skipping over those, mm-hmm. which to me, when I'm talking to clients, my addict clients about that, we're talking about how on some level they didn't develop those levels of intimacy, and which I think really then support deeper connection so that people know what we're talking about. Let's talk about different types of intimacy, because I think a lot of people think of when talk about the word intimacy, people think we're talking only about sex.
Yeah. On the interwebs, I think you can look up that there's like 10 different types of intimacy. I usually kind of keep 10, but I split them off differently. So most things, if you Google types of intimacy, they will put physical intimacy and sexual intimacy together. I do not.
Mm-hmm.
I think that that is really dangerous. And I think that physical intimacy can be platonic and non-sexual. And then you have sexual intimacy that gets into the actual sexual space. And then there's emotional, intellectual, creative, conflict, which I think is really interesting, right? When we're talking about that we're able to like work through conflict and feel closer to someone. Work intimacy, where like we can understand and kind of get in a groove in like a work or a task. I forget what it's called, but like basically like interest, like if you enjoy the same things,
have like platonic passions.
Yeah, platonic passions. So like if you're a pickleballer, pickleball is huge in Utah right now, right? Like you can develop a sense of intimacy around liking pickleball or whatever that is. And then you have like some more nuanced ones like aesthetic, which is like we kind of dress the same way, like, right? Like we like the grunge style or we like the goth style, and like we kind of gravitate towards that in a lot of things. Enjoying aesthetic would also include like enjoying the same kind of like art or performances and stuff like that and being able to connect over those.
I feel like I've named all of them. Let's see.
Physical, sexual, emotional, intellectual, creative, aesthetic, work, conflict.
I usually talk to about a spiritual.
Oh, spiritual. That's the one I missed.
Yeah.
Yeah. Spiritual intimacy is another one, right? Where we connect over our spiritual beliefs or our spiritual practices. And maybe even like, for example, like I think that you can have spiritual intimacy and not share the same belief.
Mm-hmm.
Right. But it's that understanding of like, I see you as a spiritual person. You see me as a spiritual person. We can kind of respect that space as we go deeper.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So there's a lot of different types of intimacy, which I think too, in our clinic, we will talk about intimacy that is not romantic in nature, that is not sexual in nature. And I don't think a lot of, I mean, getting into these different types of intimacy makes people aware that like there are different levels of intimacy.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, again, sometimes people put that intimacy word in terms of like their main romantic sexual relationship. And again, I don't think it has to be. I think intimacy can be platonic. And sometimes I think when there is disordered intimacy, we mistake these other types of intimacy. If we have connection, if we have an aesthetic connection or we have a emotional connection, somehow we then think there's romantic feelings attached to that.
Yeah.
When there doesn't necessarily need to be, or it would be inappropriate to attach romantic relationship or a romantic feelings to this,
mm-hmm.
sexual feelings to this. Like just having those intimate connections does not equal I am attracted to this person in a romantic or sexual way.
Yeah. And I always think about Kate Blanchett when the movie Carol came out. She got asked a lot if she'd ever had a relationship with a woman. And her response was, I have a lot of relationships with a lot of women. But if you're asking me if I've had a sexual relationship with a woman, that's an inappropriate question.
Mm.
And I just loved the fact that she kind of defended like relationships don't have to be sexual. We can be close. And that not turn into some kind of like sexualization of a relationship. Hannah Waddingham and Juno Temple also did the same thing with Ted Lasso. They got really close when they were filming Ted Lasso. And recently they both kind of said like, you know, we're protecting our relationship because people keep trying to make it something that it's not. We're just really close friends. And that is appropriate. It is appropriate to have really close friends. and to have an intimate relationship and it not be sexualized.
Mm-hmm.
And I just think that, like, that concept is really hard for the public to understand. And it's really hard when it's the same gender. It's really hard when you're talking about a male-female relationship, mm-hmm. or, you know, like a close relationship, even in a, like, a married situation, right? Like, I know one of the rules in Utah, quote unquote, is that you can't be friends with the opposite sex if you're married. And one, I think that that's a tragedy. Like, I think that we learn so much when we're in relationship with people not like us. But also, if we're sexualizing every relationship that is mixed gender, then that's going to be really problematic.
Mm-hmm. Or we just assume that people cannot have closeness and not cross lines.
Right.
I think, again, sometimes when we step back and look at these rules, or we look at these assumptions that are made, we really have a low bar for our expectation of human beings.
Yeah.
And I mean, you know, sometimes I think, oh no, we as a species are in trouble. I have those thoughts too sometimes, but I also then think, like, no, human beings can do amazing things.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to be setting that bar much higher and expecting human beings to cross, or to get over that hurdle, right? And to be able to have complex relationships with same gender, right? With opposite gender. Because, you know, you and I both have clients where maybe they are male clients and they would never have a close relationship with a male because people might think that they're gay, right?
Right.
And so they will only have close relationships with females. And it just gets so, sometimes I'm just like, you know, again, like these examples that you gave of celebrities, yes, it's going to require boundaries. It's going to require boundaries in the way you allow people to ask you about it, the way that you engage in conversations about it. And sometimes it is just setting that boundary and saying, like, if that's what your assumption is, I'm not even going to have this conversation with you.
Right. It makes me think of when I was in high school, I had a friend and he and I were really close. Like, and I still to this day do not understand why we were friends. Like, he was in the really popular crowd. I was not. And, like, we stayed friends for a long time. And up until I moved, right? And so that created a lot of just distance. But really probably up until I had my child, we were still connected. We would still see each other when I went back and things like that. And our lives just got busy. And he doesn't live in my hometown anymore either. He moved. But my mom made a statement, I don't know, 2 or 3 years ago, where she was like, oh, you had the biggest crush on him. And I was like, I did not. That was not what was happening. And she was like, oh, you were always around him. You talked about him all the time. And I was like, yeah, I want to be clear. I was not in his arousal template and he was not in mine. Like, he dated pageant girls and I wanted someone who read books. Like, that was not a, like, thing in my world at all. And my mom was like, but you were just so close. And I was like, Mom, that does not mean that I was sexually attracted to him in high school. Mm-hmm. And she was like, well, I just always assumed it was a crush. And I was like, it was not a crush. But, like, even that assumption, right? Like, mm-hmm. the assumption that, like, I was really close to this person. And I think because we were from different worlds and different backgrounds, like, we didn't have expectations of each other. And so it was really easy for us to just be ourselves, which, mm-hmm. you know, I look back on that and I think that we were good for each other in that way. But, like, he has said, I have said, there was nothing there. And sexually. But we were really close in other ways. And that is just something that people still do not understand.
Well, or sometimes I will talk to people and say, you can and should find your friends attractive.
Yes.
But that doesn't necessarily mean you are sexually attracted to them.
Yes.
Right? But if you can't be attracted to anybody outside of your primary relationship, like, it doesn't, like, why would you hang out with people? Like, if you don't find them intellectually stimulating or emotionally stimulating or attractive, mm-hmm. right, in all of these other ways, And yeah, we have to have some boundaries in place so that we don't start getting that confused in our head, or we don't start, you know, like loosening boundaries and then end up in a place that we never intended to be. But we should find other people in our social circles, quote unquote, attractive in terms of the conversation, the other types of intimacy that we are able to have and see each other as people. And I think sometimes when we make these rules or we make things very black and white, we miss the complexity of human beings. We miss the complexity of opportunities for connection and understanding. And I mean, again, this is sometimes where I, you know, tend to go big in my thinking, because I'm just like, if we could do that, how much different would our world be?
Right.
If we could see people different from us and still see them as attractive or have connection with them. I mean, to me, I think that would be a game changer in terms of some of the struggles that we face on a global level.
Yeah. I mean, you and I talked about this sometime in the last week, right? Where I said, like, I have to believe that we can have emotionally intimate platonic relationships with the opposite sex. Like, I have to believe that, because that's where change happens, right? Where there's so many places in which we don't listen to the other gender because we don't know how to. And you and I work in a, like, we work with a lot of men. We hear their stories on very emotionally deep levels, right? And it's one-sided. They don't get the same amount of intimacy from us that we get from them because of the nature of the therapeutic relationship. But a lot of the fears and complaints and hurt are similar. And there may be differences because the genders experience them different, but like the fear of being alone, or the fear of not being enough, or the fear of not measuring up shows up in both genders in some very interesting ways. And some of the work that we do with couples is just saying, like, you guys are saying the same thing. You're scared that the other person is leaving the relationship, or that they're not all in. And like, that's showing up different because of the way that you guys express that. But like, if you can hear the core fear there, like, we can make a lot of repair on that. And I just think the more conversations that we have in that space, the better, right? I kind of think about how genderized, like, we can really get into some kind of scary gendered things on like Reddit and social media, right? And it's always interesting to me when you get some of the very like pro alpha groups or whatever, like, they're not talking to women, but they're making some assumptions about what women want. And when I talk to those guys, and I'm like, wait a minute. That's actually not how I feel as a female. Like, do you want to hear what I feel and experience as a female? It's mind-blowing. Because they're not actually hearing from other women about a relationship with women, right? And I think that that's really important. I think that it's really important for us to talk to our partners, to talk to our friends, and say, like, what do you want in a relationship? What do you want in intimacy? I'm kind of getting sidetracked, but the whole point of this is when we start communicating about the kind of intimacy we want, when we start communicating and having those relationships with not just one person, that's the other thing, right? Like, if your partner becomes the basket that you put all intimacy in, that's never going to work because one person can't meet all of that. They might get close, but like, they can't. And you're going to have some individuation. You're going to have some differences, and should. And so instead of, you know, breaking your back and mind trying to change your partner on something that they may or may not ever change on, having someone, you know, that likes to go to the ballet with you or likes to listen to a certain kind of music with you and connecting over that is good. It's varied. It creates a community.
And I think, I mean, you were talking about how we get different, as genders, we get different messages, right, that cause a lot of harm between the genders, I think. And then we get messages within our gender, right, that cause a lot of harm within the gender.
Yeah.
Right?
For sure.
I think we just get a lot of really bad messages. And I think sometimes with my male clients, you know, they get messages around what type of intimacy men are allowed to do.
Yes.
And women get messaging about what types of intimacy they're allowed to do, and they're not the same.
Yeah. Right?
So sometimes working, I mean, you and I co-facilitate a men's group, right?
Yeah.
And years ago, when I kind of first was recruited into working in the sex addiction field, I wasn't a CSAT yet. It's kind of a long story. It ended up with me going out on my own and becoming a CSAT. But at the time, you know, their thinking very much was, as a female, I could not work with male sex addicts. Like, that would be inappropriate for me, right? Mm-hmm. Even though I had men reaching out to me as a therapist and asking me to be their therapist, right? And I would do that. And, you know, the people who owned that particular business, you know, would let me know that they thought it was highly inappropriate. And I just didn't quite get that. And I didn't have the wording for it until years later, where, and, you know, I know some male CSATs who I think do really great work, but I think the language I would have put, that I now know that I would put back there, is at that time period, I think sometimes, especially with sex addiction, pornography addiction, I think it would be sad for them to go through all of their healing and never have a female voice mm-hmm. as part of their healing.
Yeah.
Because I think it's something that often, not all the time, but involves those harms amongst genders, right? Whether it's female sex and love addicts, whether it's male sex and love addicts, you know, and I think that's just sometimes if we don't get the opposite gender, or sometimes, I mean, sometimes I do think there is value in getting your same gender to be like, I don't think that that's true for all women or all men, right? So I think it was just more complex than they were wanting to make it. But I think so often, you know, like, men are given messages around, like, you can have sexual desire as a form of intimacy.
Mm-hmm.
You might even have, you know, it's not uncommon for me. I mean, you and I have talked about, and several of us at our clinic, when we hear clients bring up the love languages, we're trying not to roll our eyes because we're just like, whoa, no research behind it. So it is not
a research-based book.
And it's just so
reductive.
Yes. Yes. I was going to say heteronormative, but like,
it is also heteronormative.
I'm heteronormative and I don't feel like it represents me, right? So that's where I'm like, I don't even know. It's like very seen through the eyes of men, right? That man who wrote it.
It's very like complementarian gender types.
Yes. But sometimes, you know, they'll come in, my male clients will come in and say, my love language is touch. And I'm like, and what else? And they're like, no, that's my love language. And that's where I think it does damage, because I'm often like, well, why wouldn't you become proficient in all of those love languages?
Mm-hmm.
And why focus on one and be like, sorry, I see you attempting with words of affirmation, but mine is physical touch. So nice try, good, close. But no, right?
But even in physical touch, it has to be sexual physical touch, right? And that is why I differentiate between sexual intimacy and physical intimacy, because, like, they will say physical touch, but they will not hug. They will not, like, rub backs.
Unless it's leading to sex.
Yes, right? And I would love to say that we were, like, we're taking this as an extreme, but Kelly Ripa talked about this on her day show, like, I don't know, last year, or maybe it was in COVID. It could have been a while. I don't watch Kelly Ripa. So that's I don't watch today shows.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm not there, so,
for that.
Right.
But it was a clip where she was like, yeah, you know, like, when the guy asks you if you want to do massages, and you're like, no. And the reason being is because you will give a good massage, and he will give like a 2-minute massage and then expect it to lead to sex. And I was like, oh, like, that is like, that's the baseline that we've created for physical touch.
Mm-hmm.
And there's so many great nuanced physical touches that do not lead to sex.
Mm-hmm.
And words of affirmation, if we're going to use that, right? Like, intellectual and intimacy is a place that men actually do feel really connected about, if they get to be like passionate and talk about things in a really deep way, but often they feel like they can't do that with their partner.
Right.
Because that's not one of the intimacies that women are given, FYI.
Right.
Intellectual intimacy, we're just not given that.
Right. We're supposed to, you know, like, which I think is a lot of where mansplaining comes from.
Yeah.
Right. Because the opposite gender also gets a message about what this gender, what types of intimacy they have and what types they do not. Right. So for so many, I think this is where that saying, you know, men will be men or boys will be boys. It's just almost a given in our culture that men are going to be this way. And
yeah,
what can you do about that? I mean, I guess shrug and you're just like, that's how they are. Right. Which I think, again, sets a very low bar. Or there's kind of this expectation that women aren't that intelligent and women will shy away from sometimes speaking up and offering intelligence or making a point, right? And sometimes then when they do, it's mansplained or they're interrupted and then their idea is hijacked as somebody else's, right? And so again, I think when you start to become aware of the different types of intimacy, you start to see how the messages that were given to the different genders, you will start to see them use or not use certain types. And that means what we have is not a well-rounded person.
Yeah.
And so when we do not have a well-rounded person, you know, on some level, they're aware that they're not well-rounded or they have deficiencies in this area. So they want to show up and connect in this area where they feel more confident or they feel their strengths lie here, but not here. And so I think it just becomes complicated in terms of actually developing deep intimacy.
Yeah.
That then, yes, if this is our primary sexual relationship, then that can lead into a deeper sexual connection and a deeper sexual intimacy instead of just then we have sex.
Yeah. The Goffins talk about this a lot, right? In terms of there's kind of two theories. I shouldn't say two. There are multiple theories, but there are two prevalent theories around sexual connection and how to keep your like marriage going over time. There's the Esther Perel one, which is, you know, you keep a lot of mystery in a relationship. You keep secrets. You kind of like are individuated to almost an extreme. And you only give your partner the pieces that you give your partner and then you outsource the other. And that is really reductive of what Esther Perel actually says, but I don't have an hour and a half to explain her stance. But then you have the other side of it, which is the Gottman side of it, that, and I don't know if the Gottmans and Esther Perel like agree or disagree. I don't really actually know about that, but these are kind of the thoughts that come from their work. But the Gottmans talk about like the mystery is going deeper. Right. So every time you hit a deeper layer, you're learning something new about your partner. And so you're not having to outsource as much to other people because you're learning more about your partner, you're growing together and you're going deeper together. And that is the kind of intimacy that we're talking about, right? We're talking about hitting a level of intimacy in most of those 10 types so that you can resolve things so that you can push closer. And the Goffins specifically focus a lot on conflict intimacy and how to like work through a conflict or a disagreement and be closer at the end of it and turn towards and assume positive intent from your partner versus it creating a rupture. And I just love that concept, but it's also not a skill that we are taught.
No.
And so as we are, you know, developing more ordered intimacy or more integrated intimacy is kind of what I like to say, we start to pull from our strengths into our weaknesses, right? Like I connect really well in this area, but I don't in this area. So how can I bridge that gap? And talking about like, I'm not good at this, right? Like I think that vulnerability up front is really important, right? Just being like, you know what, like I'm not really good at the whole aesthetic intimacy, the idea of like something being beautiful and leaning into that and connecting over that, like I don't really get that. Can you teach me?
Mm-hmm.
or vice versa, right? Like, I'm not really good at having deep intellectual conversations and not feeling flooded or defensive if you don't agree with me. So can we lean into that space?
Right. Yeah. And I think this is where I think also that going deeper model requires both, it requires more from both individuals.
Yes.
Right. So we can't just put that responsibility on our partner.
Right.
We also have to own, like, I have to go deep within me in order to connect there with my partner, or in order to continue to evolve myself so that I'm not just the same person I've always been. Not that we're drastically recreating ourselves, but we should, right? We should be growing. We should be evolving. We should be, you know, like slightly different every year, or have a different understanding or different perspectives if we are thinking, right? If we are feeling, if we're having discussions with people who think and feel differently than we do, right? Like all of that, I think then contributes to our own growth. It contributes to our own evolution, which then strengthens our ability to go deep in intimacy with our primary partner. I mean, it strengthens it to go deeper with our friends, with a lot of different people, maybe in our creativity or in our work. All of that, we're able to go to a deeper level.
Yeah. I think it's really important too, right? Because we always talk about change. And like, I know when I was young, right, people would tell me like, don't change. Like, you're perfect the way you are, or like, just don't change. And I don't think that that is possible as human beings. I think if we're not changing, if we're not growing, we're dying.
Mm-hmm.
But I also think we have to consider how we're doing that. When I left for college, my grandfather took me for a walk. And you and I have had conversations about my grandfather. He was one of those like sagey people that would just throw stuff out there. And you're like, okay, I don't know what that means. And then 7 years later, you're like, oh, that's what that.
I needed to be this old to understand what he was saying.
Yeah. But he took me for a walk on his property. And he was like, hey, you know the difference between a pine tree and an oak tree? And I was like, different kinds of trees.
They look different.
I mean, when he usually started conversations like this, I was like, I always kind of knew like this is going somewhere, but I don't know where he's taking this. And he was like, well, pines have shallow root systems and they shoot up really fast. They get really tall really fast, which makes them great for harvesting for wood and, you know, all that, because they're fast growing trees. And he said, but oaks take a long time to grow upwards because they dig deep. Oaks put most of their emphasis in root structure the first 50 years of life. And so they're just continuing to go deeper. So you don't see a lot of growth upward in oaks for a long time. And he said, but the ones that last, he was like, that one, pointed out a big oak. He was like, that's been hit by a tornado twice. It hasn't moved. That one, pointed to it. It was a pine tree that had gotten knocked over by a wind. He was like, that one just got wind and it fell. And he was like, be the oak. And just started walking.
Mm.
And I was like, I don't know what that means. Right? I'm 17. I'm like, okay. I'm sure that'll make sense later. But it does, right? Like, I think that that's what we're talking about when we're talking about intimacy. Like, we have to dig deep in ourselves and be willing to see our blind spots and be willing to hold space for what other people see in us and how they experience relationship with us in order for us to grow upwards and to grow out and create a relationship with the world around us.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's hard. And I think it requires a lot of trust.
Right.
And I think that that is sometimes what gets ruptured early on that creates disordered intimacy in the first place. We have a lot of messages about what we are and are not supposed to do and how we are and are not supposed to be intimate. And if we haven't had anybody that we trust, or that trust has been ruptured, to take us to those places that we're not able to grow in, that's a big leap for us to do on our own.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So we're recording this on Monday, March 11th, and today is mine and my husband's 31st wedding anniversary.
Happy anniversary.
Yeah. And so, you know, we've kind of evolved into this tradition on our anniversary of, now that our kids are older and stuff, we'll usually go out. We usually go out just for, you know, dessert, drink, something like that in the evening, and just kind of have a discussion. And we typically have a talk about just our relationship, right? And I wouldn't say it's necessarily an inventory. Sometimes it is, like just all the things that we've been through together, the ways that this relationship has changed both of us, the ways that like we were surprised, things that were unexpected that we didn't know would come about. Whether that's like, you know, sometimes for me, I will talk about like, I didn't know I could learn these things in a relationship, right? And I'm like, my younger self is really kind of surprised, but also it's healing that I was able to learn these things, right? We just kind of talk about what has happened over the years, right? And what we're proud of, and the rough times we made it through. And again, I mean, in the length of a relationship, and I think this is true in friendships too, I have friendships that go back a really long way, right? To be able to talk about just ups and downs and ways that we've grown and ways that we've healed and things that we were able to do that we didn't know that we could do those things. And we could do those things. You know, I was thinking at the beginning when you were talking about the different types of intimacy, and you were talking about like work intimacy. And I think that can be both individual, but that can be as a group where we create this synergy, right? That then something evolves that is bigger than each individual, right?
Yeah.
And I think that's really what intimacy does, is it brings out these things that were more than who we were,
mm-hmm.
and more than who we could be when we come together as human beings.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that that shows in so many ways, right? Like, I always think about the work intimacy and like what we do, right? Like, you and I have worked together now for 12 years. Mm-hmm. And in that time, like, our relationship has evolved from, you know, me being an intern and not knowing anything about anything to like, we're colleagues and we're pushing mm-hmm. and pulling each other in different directions. And we're, you know, cheering each other on and creating a space that's mm-hmm. different and bigger.
Mm-hmm. And well, my husband knows if I'm getting home later than, you know, I said like, hey, I'll be done at this time. And then I get home clearly much later than it took to drive home. He'll be like talking to Rachel.
I'm like, yep.
Yep.
Yeah. My husband will say, you got in late last night.
Yep.
another jam sesh.
Yep.
And I think that is right. Like when you're in so many ways, these pieces of intimacy, these categories of intimacy are why we live to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
Right. It's that moving into a space in which like life has meaning in multiple spaces.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that when we are taught to sterilize those and keep a certain level of propriety, maybe mm-hmm. is the right word, because like I think you can have boundaries, but there is something difference between like having appropriate boundaries and propriety. And I think that there's a level that in which it just doesn't allow us to go deeper. It doesn't allow us to question mm-hmm. what the boundaries are individually
mm-hmm.
and what that looks like. And I do think even that is a conversation, right? Like we talked at the first part of this about boundaries and how like you can have deep connections with people and it not be sexual.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to check those, right? Like if we feel that we're moving into a more intimate space or into a different intimate category than we have been in, whether it's sexual or something else, like we need to check that verbally with the people that like, not just assume that we know where it's going, but really like, hey, I feel this. Is this me? Is this us? Are we good with this? Right? Like, I think that there's a level of consent that has to happen in intimacy. I think that there's a level of consent that needs to happen in anything.
Right.
But right, when we're talking about intimacy, like we need to make sure that we all feel safe going there
mm-hmm.
because that is not going to feel safe for some of us. And that's right. Like, especially if it's a category or a place that like trust has been broken, we're going to have to go very softly into like, I think this relationship can go deeper in work intimacy. Is that something that you're open to, or are you good with where we're at? And just checking that out. And obviously you can have a deeper conversation than the one I just gave you, but that I think is really important to have these like above board conversations around what does our intimacy look like?
Mm-hmm.
What does physical intimacy look like to you? What does sexual intimacy look like to you? Where does that line cross? Right? Because for some people, platonic physical intimacy crosses into other people's sexual boundaries.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to have those conversations.
Right.
Emotional intimacy can feel very, like we can have a very emotionally intimate relationship, but not a very physically intimate relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And if we're not paying attention, we can cross somebody's boundaries and not know them.
Right. Yeah.
And that ruptures the friendship or the relationship or whatever that is.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's, you know, it's really interesting to me when we're looking at like sexual harassment lawsuits and work and things like that. Some of that is because we have disordered intimacy as a society.
Yeah.
Right. And so like what feels like normal colleague work intimacy to one person feels like sexual flirting to another.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, one person thinks I'm just being nice and the other person thinks like, no, you're not.
Right.
And what that looks like and how that looks and all of that.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think you can have, you know, certain, talking about like sexual harassment at work. I mean, I think you can have all sorts of power dynamics that
yes.
come into play that layer over
yeah.
different types of intimacy. I mean, again, we're not getting into maybe a different episode. We can talk about like the intersection of power dynamics and intimacy, right? Because I think
yeah.
that's something you have to be mindful of so that it doesn't get abused or misused and instead is used in really positive leadership kind of ways. I know you've got a presentation you're doing for ITAO
yeah.
this Friday on the myths of, I mean, I forget your topic.
It's not an object.
Not an object.
Addressing the myths of female sexuality and how they damage both partners and addicts.
Yeah, yeah. And I come across, this was a couple weeks ago, I sent it to you. And it was just, it was from a magazine back in the 50s, right? It was just talking
It hurt, right?
It was talking about, like, basically, it was totally serious,
yeah.
right? But it was like how to be a good wife, basically, right?
I haven't.
Okay. It was so bad. And in that way, I'm like, okay, we have come a long way from maybe the 50s. And we still have a ways to go, even though these things we can read and be somewhat shocked and be somewhat horrified. I was somewhat horrified at some of the suggestions for being a good wife. Do you have it pulled up?
Yeah. I'm not going to read the whole thing, but this is just an excerpt that I think is just insane to me. When it comes to the possibility of intimate relations with your husband, it is important to remember your marriage vows, and in particular, your commitment to obey him. If he feels he needs to sleep immediately, then so be it. In all things, be led by your husband's wishes. Do not pressure him in any way to stimulate intimacy. Should your husband suggest Congress, then agree humbly, all the while being mindful that a man's satisfaction is more important than a woman's.
Right. Yeah.
It's a long thing, but like, even in here, right, we're talking about intimacy.
Right.
As sex.
Yes. Well, and really, male sexuality.
Male sex.
Right. Right. I mean, because in there, and I remember, I mean, this would have been years ago, I had an older client, but not that, I didn't think she was that old. She was probably in her 50s at the time, but I was probably in my 30s, right? And so 50 seemed much older to me than it does now when I'm in my 50s. But, you know, she was talking about, I mean, they were having marital issues. I mean, she was the only one coming to therapy, of course. And of course, they're having marriage issues, right? But she would talk about, like, and it suggested this in this article, like, she wouldn't remove her makeup or anything before he was asleep, right? Because they should see you looking your best at all times. And then she would get up at some god-awful hour in the morning to, like, get ready for the day and have her hair all ready, because heaven forbid he see her in her curlers. Or, like, I was just like, you do what? Like, your husband has, like, I remember saying to her, your husband has never seen you without makeup. And she's like, no. And I'm like, and he is, how does he think your hair gets done? Like, it's just done when he wakes up at 6 o'clock in the morning and your makeup is all on. And she's like, yeah. And I, like, to me, I'm just like, there's a level of intimacy that's missing here. And I don't even think I can communicate to her what is missing. Cause, like, I was just like, I don't even think you have a framework for why your relationship might not be working. Like,
right.
Cause you're not actually a person.
Yeah. Leanne Eisler wrote The Chalice and the Blade that you and I read together a couple of years ago. She has another book, and I cannot for the life of me remember the title.
I think I read it. If she only has two.
Yeah, I think she only has two. I read this one for my presentation.
Okay.
But it's talking about egalitarian relationships, right? Like, it's talking about how you can't have a power, like, you can't actually have a power dynamic in a relationship and it be functional, and it be a functional partnership. And I, like, the more I look at this and the more I think about it, and it's part of my presentation on Friday, is, like, a power over dynamic in a relationship ruptures intimacy.
Right.
You can't be fully human for either party, right? Because the person who is over, right? Like, if you're looking at a stereotypical complementarian relationship where the husband is over the wife, like, he is expected to be bulletproof,
mm-hmm.
right? In some ways, like, he is just a step under God,
right? He's also non-human.
He's not human. He doesn't get to be human. He has to, like, perform some insane, like, emotional and mental gymnastics
mm-hmm.
to function in that capacity. And the wife or the female partner in a heteronormative relationship also doesn't get to be human
mm-hmm.
because it's kind of her job to pick up all of the stuff that, like, he can't do
mm-hmm.
in this relationship. And so it's just breaking each other, right? And no one gets to talk about, like, how hard it is to hold those spaces
right.
and, like, how unfair it feels and, like, how scary it is. I have a client who recently lost his jaw, and he just keeps saying in therapy, like, I have to find another job because, like, my job is to provide so she can stay home with the kids. And I'm like, when did that become a thing for you? And he's like, that's just the rule. Like, and he actually said that's just the rule. Men provide. And I'm like, men provide what?
Mm-hmm.
What are we providing? And I think that's some of it, right? Like, it's impossible to be intimate when you're so worried about creating this image for the other person.
Because, well, can be authentic. And sometimes I've had clients where, you know, they are providing,
right,
as the male, you know, who's supposed to apparently provide. And their spouse knows very little about their day in, day out
right.
at work, right? Even though they're there sometimes for many hours,
right?
They don't talk about it at home. They don't bring it up. Like, they also, because I think sometimes part of that rule is you provide and you make it look easy.
Yes.
And
it's not a burden.
Yeah. Yeah. You just do it.
Right.
Right. And so then there's this whole chunk of the day that you're not even discussing with your partner, or stresses that may be following you home because it's not always possible to leave them at the office. Right. And you just don't say anything. You're not sharing that part of your life.
It's really interesting because I have a bias. I don't think that complementarian relationships really work. But my parent-in-laws, they have the dynamic where he worked and she stayed at home with the kids. And they had three kids, and she did work sometimes. Like, it wasn't, like, a consistent thing. But it honestly, between childcare and all of that, it was cheaper for her to stay home versus trying to get another job and supplement income. And she owned her own craft business at one point too. It was, whatever. Anyway, watching them talk about their that specific part of their relationship, though, I have to say, like, I admire, because they always treated his job as we.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't his job. It was our job. And how they supported each other in that. And so, yeah.
And he owned his own company, right?
He managed a company. Okay. Yeah. It was a family-owned company that he managed. And then it got bought out by a larger conglomerate.
Okay.
And he stayed on as manager and then kind of moved up in the company. But yeah, he was pretty, you know,
he had some personal stake in the company.
Yeah, he had a lot of personal stake in the company. And watching how, like, certain times of year when inventory and things like that would come up and, like, he would have to be kind of invested in all of that, right? She would do a lot to kind of support on the back end and make sure that he was doing okay emotionally and, like, checking on him with self-care and things like that. And on the other side, right, when she was stressed with things with the kids or with other stuff, right, like, he would lean into that and be like, okay, how can I help you? Like, it's not your job to just clean the house all the time. And, like, so they balanced that relatively well, considering the stereotypes
mm-hmm.
of this kind of format. And I would say that that's probably the most relational that I have seen those spaces, because they considered everything we, right? Like, yeah, he was the one actually going to the office and doing the work, but they were doing it together, and it was their money. It wasn't him making the money for her and vice versa. So it was very much a we attitude, and I think that did create some intimacy for them.
Yeah,
but I don't see that a lot.
No, we don't see that a lot.
I also, and I know we don't have a lot of time, but I also want to talk about this idea of being able to connect, like, one form of intimacy being safer
mm-hmm.
and being able to connect that way, but then not really able or willing to give other forms of intimacy to your mm-hmm. partner. We see this a lot, like, with sex addicts. They're very willing to be vulnerable sexually in order to keep other parts of themselves safe
mm-hmm.
or vice versa, right? Where they're willing to be emotionally intimate with people they're not sexual with, or sexually intimate with people that they're not going to be intimate with right. any other way. And kind of talk about, like, that dynamic and what that looks like.
Yeah. I think for a lot of times when there is disordered intimacy, it feels dangerous or it feels threatening to be too intimate with any one person.
Mm-hmm.
And so we start to divide that amongst different people, right? I mean, with some of the clients we work with, they've divided up amongst different sex partners.
Mm-hmm.
And so again, it's, you know, I've had clients where they hire escorts, but any hint of a relationship, they never hire that escort again, right? So they're very non-relational, but sexual with them
mm-hmm.
and have problems sometimes being sexual with the people there emotionally, physically, intellectually, all those other types of intimacy. They have a hard time being sexual with them, right? Now, sometimes there's some trauma around sexuality. And so that's why it kind of gets that fractured,
mm-hmm.
fractured thing, right? But I think there can be types of trauma where, you know, I mean, we live in Utah, we see quite a few religious clients, right? And I've had some of my male clients just say, you know, it does not feel respectful to be sexual with this daughter of God because
mm-hmm.
sex doesn't feel virtuous.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, I would say that's low on the sexual trauma, but there has been some sexual trauma around that. A lot of times with some of my clients, their belief is women don't actually want sex.
Yeah.
And that is damaging to them. They have a sadness around that, right? And so there's just different ways that this can fracture and that the sexual piece and the other forms of intimacy can't really be integrated,
right,
in an integrated way. They just can't be because it's not how they learned that, right?
Right.
I mean, sometimes, again, they came from a mesh family systems, and so doesn't feel safe to be intimate with,
right,
any one person, or to allow like 3 to 4 people to get really intimate with you, right? Not all sexual, but like just really be known. That doesn't feel safe, but that has a lot to do with their enmeshment, right? Sometimes it has to do with disengagement, or they came from a disengaged family system and closeness doesn't feel safe,
right? I think it's really interesting kind of going back to the family systems, because you and I have talked about this a lot, how layered that gets with, because, right, I think that we like to believe that we get to adulthood and all the things that we experienced in childhood didn't affect us.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why that became a narrative in our culture, but it did.
Mm-hmm.
That even that, right, like I was just thinking, like, right, an enmeshed abusive system, right, like one that is physically or emotionally abusive and enmeshed, there's not any boundaries, right? So like the idea that something intimate and tender to you could be then used against you later,
mm-hmm,
is also really scary. And a disengaged family system, like, you didn't learn how to water that plant, you didn't learn how to take care of it, so like why would you know how to go there for yourself? Because no one did. And I think even looking at that in terms of like different forms of intimacy and like giving it to different people, right, there's also this level of like, if I give my integrated self, like if I show up integrated, if I am allowed to be my own form of intimacy for one person and that one person rejects me, then it validates all of my feelings of I'm not enough, or I'm too big, or I'm too much, or, you know, I'm unlovable.
I value, yeah.
Right? Like, at a core, I'm unlovable. I have value. All of those, right? Like, that can be really scary. So, of course, we're going to give people disintegrated pieces of ourselves that we know that they will attach to,
mm-hmm,
to a certain point, right? And that would be that wall that we hit, because you can't get behind that wall,
right?
I also think it's interesting when you said that about, like, a daughter of God. It made me think about, too, if we grew up and this doesn't have to be religious, right? Like, I hear this from all kinds of different family settings where sex just wasn't talked about and, like, sexual intimacy wasn't talked about. We don't really have an idea what that's supposed to be as adults, right? Or if it wasn't talked about and it was abused, we don't have an idea of what that feels like safely. And so in that space of like trying to create sexual intimacy with a person we care about, we don't have format for that.
Uh-huh.
And so it can be very difficult to say like, I love you and I care about you. And like, I want to be close to you. And I have no idea how to do this thing that we're supposed to do.
Uh-huh. Right. Yeah. So let's wrap that episode today. We'll talk about this more. If you have questions, you can feel free to reach out to me. And we love getting questions that people want us to talk a little bit more about this or have a question about something that sometimes we just kind of mention it in passing and people are like, wait, well, what?
What was this?
That's actually what happened
in this episode.
And so we love getting that feedback. So if you have some questions about what we've talked about, we will do a couple more podcast episodes around this topic. But if you have something specific in mind, please feel free to reach out. And then at the end of this episode, I want to remind you that your story matters. Remember, there's something meaningful in every chapter. Don't wait to share your story until it's finished. Until next time, Jackie. The Legal Stuff. This podcast is solely for the purpose of information and education and does not constitute therapy, nor should it replace competent professional help. Prayer of the Perfectionist. Nobody has time for perfection. We are pursuing progress. Help me to remember the only step I need to focus on is the next right step for me. Help me to remember that life is a journey. Help me be able to separate all that I am learning from all that I have to do. Help me to remember that I am not alone. I can ask for help. Help me to strive for frequent awakenings, not mastering. I am enough. Amen.